Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Well, first of all, I'm not just trying to make beekeepers. I'm trying to make ambassadors for bees and beekeeping.
That's beekeeper Rob Green, who offers classes for beginning beekeepers through the Indiana Beekeeping School. Later in the program, he'll talk about what the curious case of colony collapse disorder for bees could end up meaning for the food system. We'll also stop by the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market to pick up some collard greens for a Brazilian-inspired dish. And broccoli rounds out the menu today, a recipe that could serve as the main dish of any dinner meal. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. But first, news blogger Liz Leslie is here with a look at this week's food headlines. Welcome, Liz.
Hi, Annie. Good to be here. The biggest buzz this week came from celebrity cook Paula Deen when she announced to Al Roker Tuesday she was living with type 2 diabetes. The cook, known for her high-fat, high-sugar comfort food and a southern drawl, said she was diagnosed 3 years ago, but chose now to go public after becoming a paid spokesperson for a diabetes medication maker, Novo Nordisk. Deen stands defiantly by her food, saying she has always preached moderation and her meals are not meant to become a lifestyle. Genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, went to the California State Assembly Thursday with the Consumer Right to Know Act. Genetically engineered salmon is poised to become the first GE animal approved for consumption by the FDA. Filmmaker Robert Kenner of Food Inc. launched the Just Label It campaign, calling on consumers to take a stand to know what's in their food. Just Label It launched with a video this week as part of Kenner's Fix Food social media platform. Finally, does this figure surprise you? One-third of food worldwide goes to waste, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Addressing food waste is a complicated problem. Factors ranging from infrastructure to cosmetics lead to food waste, and the biggest offenders are developing nations. Often, developing nations lack refrigeration, stable roads, and the ability to get raw food from farm to the market. Industrialized nations are also addressing food waste with small steps, like throwing away less edible food in the kitchen and providing eco-friendly doggy bags. Read more about these stories and many more on our website, eartheats.org.
And follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Just search for Earth Eats. Liz Leslie is a news blogger for Earth Eats. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
Soon, when you go out to eat at some restaurants, you'll know more about what's on the menu. Federal regulations coming this year will require many chains to list the number of calories in the food they serve. But the question is, will that lead you to make healthier choices? Grant Gerlach reports from Nebraska for Harvest Public Media.
Counting calories when you go out to eat can be a bit of a guessing game. Just ask customers at this Amigos restaurant in Lincoln. It's a Nebraska-based chain that serves tacos, burritos, also burgers and fries.
Jessica Zangari, I'm from Lincoln.
Andrew Wells, from Lincoln. I got two cheesy burritos and a taco and Mexi fries.
Meat nachos.
Any idea what the calorie count might be on those?
Probably 700-800, I don't know.
I have no idea either. Yes, 600.
Jessica's nachos actually have just over 1,000 calories. Andrew's burritos, taco, and fries come to almost 1,300. It's not a surprise that they had trouble coming up with an accurate number. Christina Roberto studies food labeling at Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity.
People have a really hard time estimating the calories in restaurant food because we know when people eat out, they tend to eat foods that are higher in calories. The foods tend to be of poor nutritional quality. They're served in really large portions, and we know that that promotes overeating.
So regulators will require restaurants to display calorie numbers next to items on their menus. Behind the rules are a couple other numbers. Almost 34% of all adults in the U.S. are obese, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And to keep from gaining weight, most people need to stick to 2,000 calories per day.
When it comes to the obesity problem that we're faced with and people having excess weight, I think calories is a very reasonable place to start because ultimately that's what, you know, what people need to focus on if they do want to lose weight.
The healthcare reform law passed in 2010 got the ball rolling on putting calorie numbers on menus. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is finalizing the new rules, and new menus could be in place by mid-2012 at restaurant chains with more than 20 locations. That includes Amigos, with 29 restaurants, all in Nebraska.
It would be a very big change.
Jan Moore co-founded Amigos with her husband Roger 31 years ago. Almost everything on the Amigos menu has been analyzed and calories calculated, but Moore says what people actually order is often more complicated than what's on the menu.
It would make a difference if it's French fries or Mexi fries in our restaurant. And then also it makes a difference if they order a diet drink or a regular drink. And, you know, we have people that add sour cream, hold sour cream.
Dan Rail says these are the kinds of things FDA is still working to clear up. He's Senior Director of Government Relations for the National Restaurant Association. Rail says custom orders like hold the mayo or extra cheese don't have a spot on the menu, and every order can be different.
You know, you have to deal with, you know, how do you label pizzas that have 34 million different combinations that you can make? And it really does become a fairly complex undertaking.
Who's going to check and make sure restaurants are making changes and being honest? Rail says the FDA may spot check locations, or they may lean on local public health departments to follow up.
The most popular thing on the menu at Amigos is the soft taco. If you get a combo with a 20-ounce Pepsi and Mexi fries, which are like tater tots, you're getting a meal with 1,100 calories. Right now, you wouldn't know that unless you went online in advance. Soon, anyone will be able to do the math from the menu. But will it make a difference?
Yeah, well, that's the million-dollar question. And what's happened in terms of menu labeling research is that the findings are pretty mixed.
Roberto at the Rudd Center says some studies show a big impact. Some show only a small portion of customers cutting back on calories.
But when you're thinking about a public health problem, even if you have part of the population doing that, it can really have a meaningful impact.
Roberto also says with calories on the menu, it may not be just consumers changing their habits. Restaurants might also decide to cut back.
Some of these chain restaurants in particular, they have menu items that are your whole day's worth of calories, you know, 2,000 calories for an appetizer or a side dish. So we're already starting to see Cheesecake Factory announcing a Skinnylicious menu, Olive Garden saying they're going to bring the calorie counts down in their foods.
Amigos Jan Moore says over the years, she's chased after different health trends, but she senses a more lasting change may be setting in. Their low-calorie Fiesta Fit menu was introduced a year ago.
And for the first time, the public responded, and they sold well enough that we kept them on our menu all year round. They're still on. So more than ever, the public is responding and concerned. How much it affects their buying patterns is hard to say.
Consumers will eventually have the numbers in front of them, but it will still be their choice whether to add them up. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Grant Gerlach.
Read more from the team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Thanks to winter farmers markets, eating fresh and local can continue throughout all four seasons. In December, the USDA reported the number of winter farmers markets across the country has increased 38% from 886 in 2010 to 1,225 in 2011. The Bloomington, Indiana winter farmers market has been in operation since 2005, and it runs from early December through the end of March. Chef Daniel Orr stopped by the market to pick up some winter greens and mushrooms, and he chatted with his fellow shoppers while he was there.
Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, how about you? Yeah. Our shiitake mushrooms, we get a log that is made of sawdust and grain. It's not a compost mushroom like a portobello or a white button. The shiitake's within a 24-hour period, they double their size, so they grow very quickly. When all the grain is gone, they start to compost themselves. They just crumble and fall apart, and we actually put it out on the field as a compost for our produce.
Excuse me, do you mind my asking, what did you buy today?
I bought a big old chunk of cheese, about 4 pounds.
I bought 10 pounds of cheese also to go run away into the woods and eat cheese for a month.
We'll be back.
And all right. You will too.
Yeah, we're here all the time.
Okay.
Thank you. Sure.
What's going on?
How you doing?
Man, it's good to see you.
Yeah.
What's going on?
I'm Mandy Corey. I own and operate Schacht Farm with my husband. It's about 10 minutes south of here on Schacht Road. We do a little bit of everything. Eggs, chicken, turkey, beef, lamb, pork, starting with duck and geese as well. So, I mean, even today I got a lot of questions about, you know, when does lambing season start and that sort of thing. People that are really invested in us and what we do. And so they're kind of our cheerleaders, really.
What's going on?
So we're here at the winter market with Jeff Finch, and he's the owner with his wife of Finch's Restaurant in Bloomington. One of the great things they do here at the farmer's market is to do cooking demonstrations. And just tell us a little bit about what you made today.
Made a Moroccan lamb meatball with some local lamb. Also used some local eggs from Teresa Bertels and Heartland Family Farms. But it's a great way for us to get out and show people what's going on, what can be used, and how we provide a recipe. And it also helps to expose the farms and duly expose our restaurant, so it works for everybody.
This is a community building event, so it's not just money and food exchanging hands, it's community being built.
If you want to find a farmer's market close to you, check out the National Farmer's Market search engine through the USDA. Find a link to that from our website, eartheats.org. Now Chef Orr goes into the kitchen to cook up the collard greens he just bought.
Today we're going to make a Brazilian dish, which is called couve. And in Brazil, they serve it with their national dish, which is called feijoada. And that is a black bean and pork stew that they put everything but the oink in. So this is the couve, which we call collard greens. And you want to pick some really nice, fresh-looking ones. We're going to remove most of the main stem here. The great thing about collard greens and cabbage and Brussels sprouts, all of these are late winter greens. Okay, now what we're going to do for this dish, now a lot of times with collard greens and other greens, they're cooked a long time, they're stewed with a lot of bacon and pork parts, but what we want to have is a nice accompaniment to go with kind of a stewed dish. This would also be great with just a simple light fish on top or a grilled chicken breast, so you can use it in a lot of different ways. Okay, what you want to do with this, which is a little different than most collard green dishes, is you're going to cut them as finely as you can. You're forming what the French call a chiffonade, which means thin ribbon. What this allows you to do is to have collard greens without having them stew for, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes, or if you're my grandmother, 3 hours. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to chop some ginger. Now, a lot of people don't know that the best way to peel ginger is actually with a spoon. So what you do is you take your spoon and you just rake it across the ginger root, and we're just going to mince this up. Now, when you mince ginger, what you want to do is cut it across the grain. After you've made those little slices, you just stack those up, cut them into a julienne or matchstick cut, and then when you turn them again and you cut them again, you're going to have a brunoise or a fine, fine dice. Now I have the rest of my ingredients prepared here, and we're going to take it to the stove. For the couve, or the collard greens, I want to have a nice large pan with a lot of surface area. And what I'm going to do is add some extra virgin olive oil to that. Anytime you're sautéing something, you want to have your pan hot and then add your cold oil. And what that will do is it'll help prevent sticking. All right, we're going to add our onions. Got some red onions. Add some of that nice ginger and the garlic. Okay, I'm just gonna stir that up. I'm going to add that nice thinly cut collard to this. And I'm just going to stir to incorporate it. And basically all we want to do is wilt the collard greens. And you can already see that this would make a really wonderful bed to put underneath a lot of different things. Okay, so you see how this is kind of wilted. I'm going to season it with the lemon zest, a little bit of salt and pepper. Okay, I'm going to give it a little taste. That's nice. It's wholesome. It has that kind of minerally flavor of the cruciferous greens. Okay, we're just going to mound this up. Classically, in Brazil, you'd have some orange slices with your feijoada, so I'm going to decorate the collard greens with some orange segments. And then I also have some roasted tomatoes that we use a lot here at Farm, and it brings you back those vibrant colors of the spring and summer, even though it's cold outside.
Coming up, what buzzes produces a sweetener for your tea and is responsible for pollinating some $15 billion worth of crops in the U.S.? The honeybee, of course. I speak with a beekeeper about the joys and the sorrows of having your own backyard apiary. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood and on West 6th Street, two blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973, located downtown on the west side of the square, and online at goodsforcooks.com.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. There's a resurgence in backyard beekeeping these days. According to the annual USDA survey, there were 2.68 million honeybee colonies producing honey in 2010. That's up 7% from 2009. In a lot of ways, this is a return to the way things were done back in the day.
100-150 years ago in Indiana, people couldn't go down to the corner Kroger and pick up a pound of sugar. And in fact, if you go back far enough, recipes didn't call for sugar at all. They called for honey.
Rob Green is founding director and president of Indiana Beekeeping School Incorporated, through which he teaches beginning beekeeping classes.
The fact is, honeybees have lived side by side with people since virtually the beginning of time. It's always was kind of a love-love relationship until more recently, where we've become a people who want to kill anything that flies through our garden. But with a population crash over the last 15, 20 years, the feral or wild honeybees that used to live in the hollow trees at the end of the road and then the parks, they're more or less gone.
The statistics about the honeybee disappearance don't lie. According to another USDA survey of over 5,500 beekeepers, there was a total loss of 30% of honeybee colonies nationwide last year. 31% of beekeepers reported losing at least some of their colonies without finding dead bee bodies, which is one of the symptoms that defines colony collapse disorder, or CCD. And those 31% of beekeepers reported higher average colony losses, 61%, compared to beekeepers who lost colonies but found the dead bees. That was only 34%. Researchers have been trying to figure out the root of CCD since the phenomenon cropped up in 2006. Part of the problem may be a relatively new class of pesticides called neonicotinoids, or neonics, that we're using on food crops and in gardens and parks. Researchers think that has something to do with it, but it's also probably habitat destruction, loss of food resources, poor quality food, viruses, and fungal diseases. Whatever the reason, it's a big problem, as bees are responsible for pollinating about $15 billion worth of crops.
And they are vital to our agriculture and our healthy gardens, and really our health itself, because there's not very much exciting food if you remove all the fresh fruit, vegetables, even the beef and milk in our diet, because alfalfa is pollinated by honeybees. And the only way you get alfalfa seed for planting in a new field is by pollinated alfalfa flowers, and that takes a bee. But, you know, unless you want to eat a lot of porridge, we really want to look after the honeybee. Apple trees are a perfect example. You get less than 3 to 5% of the apples on a tree if it's not visited by a honeybee, because the flower of an apple blossom is the perfect size for the honeybee. And the honeybee is the perfect size for the apple blossom. And not only that, but apple blossoms need cross-pollination. They need pollen in this flower from another apple tree over there. And this little bee, with a brain the size of the head of a pin, knows enough to do this.
He says it's this sense of awe of honeybees that gets new beekeepers hooked. When he started his apiary in a residential neighborhood with no fences, thank you very much, he had 10 hives. But then he just kept expanding. So he bought a 22-acre farm, Bluffwood Creek Farm, which now houses 30 hives.
One of the reasons I bought my farm is there's a stand of silver maple trees, and everybody looked at it and said, silver maples, you know, they break off in the storms and they're a weedy tree. But that's my early spring breakfast buffet for my bees when nothing else is blooming.
Those trees blossom as early as February. Farming anything in the Midwest can be tricky, whether it's vegetables or bees. And being an organic farmer like Green requires an extra bit of creativity, like when he treats his bees for parasitic mites.
The ones that are on the outside of the bees, I actually sprinkled a form of powdered sugar on them. I could use talcum powder, but that would make my honey probably taste like baby powder. Just sprinkling a food product on the bees, a fine powdered sugar, causes the mites to slip and fall off.
As for the weather, inevitable summer droughts, which result in wilted flowers, make the bees' job more difficult and the beekeeper's blood pressure rise.
This past year actually wasn't so bad because in spite of the drought, we had very heavy dews in the morning. And my alfalfa, which bees happen to love, was in bloom all summer. I was cutting it in stages. And the clover was a good crop, and I had one of my best years ever this year, the drought notwithstanding.
Green tries to pass on the love of bees when he teaches beginning beekeepers by emphasizing the joy of managing an apiary.
So really, a day in the life of a beekeeper, once the bees are doing their thing, is you go out and you watch them. You sit in a chair by the side of the beehive and watch them coming and going, and you're looking for an excuse to go inside. But you just went in yesterday, and you're getting into the area of micromanagement, and you know your bees would prefer you to stay outside for a couple of days.
Rob Green offers beekeeping classes at the end of January through the Indiana Beekeeping School. Learn more about that on their website, indianabeekeepingschool.com. Rob Green's farm is Bluffwood Creek Organic Farm and Apiary, and that website is bluffwoodcreek.com. One more recipe from Chef Daniel Orr today, using a vegetable that is, yes, pollinated by honeybees.
All right, today we're talking broccoli. It's a flower, and if you would let this stay on the plant, it would actually sprout little yellow flowers on top of it. But when it gets bigger like this, it's great to cook Italian style. And a lot of people think of broccoli just as a side vegetable, you know, something that comes along with a foil-wrapped baked potato and a big chunk of meat. But in Italy, they treat it more as the star of the show. We're just going to cut this, each one of these florets, about into quarters or thirds. And we're going to blanch these off. It's where you have boiling salted water, plunge the vegetables into the water, and then you shock it by plunging them from when they're just very lightly cooked from the boiling water into ice water until they're cold all the way through. So we've got our blanched broccoli here. I'm going to take a few basil leaves, get that nice cinnamony, spicy aroma. We're going to put just a little bit of rosemary. Okay, spread that down on the bottom of the pan. Tear the leaves up just a little bit. Okay, then I'm going to lay out my blanched broccoli just kind of in one even layer so it cooks really quickly. Okay, and then I'm going to take a little olive oil. Sprinkle it on top, about a tablespoon of chopped garlic on top, a little bit of my favorite lemon zest, okay, and then up under the broiler. Okay, and since the broccoli is already par-cooked, it's not going to take long. If you're doing this in the summertime and you had the grill going, you could also do this over the grill, take it out to the barbecue, and you can use that as your kind of vegetarian starter if you'd like.
So you're just looking for it to get a little dark on the top?
Yeah, I want it to see that little bit of caramelization, almost a touch of burning. In French, they call it ferré, which means burnt but not burnt.
And they're sweating a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Those little broccoli soldiers are—they're in the heat of battle right now. Okay, so it's probably been about 2 or 3 minutes. We got that little bit of char on them. We're going to put them onto a serving platter. Okay, and then I've got some toppings. And again, this is up to you, whatever you'd like to use. I'm going to put some anchovies, good source of your omega-3s. Just kind of rip them up. A little gorgonzola cheese, Italian blue cheese, some black olives, toasted pine nuts, and a little bit of tomato. Okay, we're going to finish all that off with a little touch of extra virgin olive oil and a good squeeze of some lemon juice. And that's our Tuscan-style roasted broccoli.
As always, visit our website to find all these recipes and many more. While you're there, read interviews and news updates and subscribe to our weekly podcast. It's all at eartheats.org. Special thanks today to Rob Green, Gene Count, Liz Leslie, Chef Daniel Orr, and everyone at Harvest Public Media.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood, and on West 6th Street, 2 blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973, located downtown on the west side of the square, and online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Next week, we'll have two more recipes using cold weather veggies, and perhaps my favorite Earth Eats recipe of all time, the Harrison Lake Garden Burger. I can't wait. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.